This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this Lattice Training Podcast. In this podcast, I chat with Stacey Sims. Stacey is a sport physiologist from New Zealand who has focused on female physiology in her research, as well as published a number of books in this area. She is known for coining the phrase, "Women are not small men." In this conversation, we talk about the menstrual cycle, how Stacey views the current research, and how she arrives at a practical application of this information in a training context. Now, this is a huge topic, and I want to start with the caveat that we do not go into every nuance in this podcast. The experience of the menstrual cycle varies greatly between individuals, and a portion of athletes won't experience any symptoms that they feel impact their performance or training. Stacey approaches talking about training in the menstrual cycle a bit differently, in that she talks about phased-based training, which does not have a great body of research behind it, rather than looking into acute performance and how this may change across the menstrual cycle, or how our perception of our performance may change across the menstrual cycle. And these are areas where there is more research behind it. I just want to acknowledge that research looking at acute performance and how this may change across the menstrual cycle is inconclusive as to whether or not cycle phase impacts performance. As with many things in the world of training, the ideas that Stacey discusses should be seen as options to explore and be monitored to see if they have a positive impact. If this is especially true if you feel that a current training approach could be further optimized with respect to your cycle. In the second part of this podcast, we discuss the menopause and the hormonal transition that leads up to this point, known as perimenopause. Stacey talks through the mechanisms underpinning some of the changes that occur with a focus on athletes. This is then pulled back to some practical changes we can make to help maintain our love for training and climbing throughout this transition. I hope you enjoy. Well, I am really excited to get to talk to you today. And we're going to talk about some topics that I think kind of nowadays fall under a bit of an umbrella term of the female athlete. But I don't know, you may sort of have some different terminology for the area that you feel that you dedicate your time to and work in. But you have been very influential in the development of my own interest in this area. And I think that is probably true for a lot of women out there. You know, I remember reading your book, Raw, and then, you know, I think a lot of people will have seen your TED Talk, Women Are Not Small Men. And from there, you've obviously continued to share information in this area, work on developing an app, you've worked in research in this area. So, you know, I really think you cover this topic from a few different angles, you know, which I think is something that is really, really great to see. And I think from where I'm standing, it makes a nice level of accessible information for people looking to learn about this area out there. And so I think to a number of our listeners today, you will be a known, you know, a known person. But just in case we have people listening who haven't heard about you, do you want to just give yourself a little bit of an introduction and maybe a little bit of background about your interest in this area of sort of sport performance for the female athlete and how it's grown?
So I guess the big words are I'm a female athlete performance physiologist, but really, it comes down to my interest in understanding women, women's bodies, and why research has neglected us for so long, to the point where we are relying on data that are our guidelines for training periodization, for recovery, nutrition, have been primarily generalized from male data until we start looking a little bit closer at some of the newer stuff that's starting to emerge. Before we started, I was on a call with a friend's daughter who is now in uni, and she was very frustrated with her instructor just spouting information as if it was fact. And she's like, but this is based on men. And she's telling me the story. And I was like, what, how can this be happening in 2022? This is the reason why I got into this. Because when I was at uni and I was asking questions of that didn't make sense to me as a female athlete, trying to find out more information to better myself and teammates. And I would get, this is what it is. We don't study women. And I'm like, what do you mean we don't study women? Well, women have a menstrual cycle. Women don't participate. Women are the same as men. So we don't really have to include them. So all of those little jabs at women really made me very frustrated, which is kind of what benchmarked me into pursuing this from an academic standpoint, but also being a competitive high-level athlete for most of my life, wanting to find a competitive edge for myself and my teammates. And yeah, and then finding so many women not understanding their bodies, relying on protocols and information that they've gotten from their coaches or from other places and getting sick and not being able to perform well. And it's like, wait, we've got to stop. We got to get the right information out. So that's why my TED Talk was Women Are Not Small Men.
Yeah. And that's actually really interesting to hear you having a conversation so recently with someone who is now studying and I guess kind of saying that her experience is still the same as yours. Yours was, you know, those years back when you started studying. And so I guess that's actually just prompted a bit of an introductory question in that from your perspective, have you seen much change or are we still really working to change some people's ideas around this?
When we look at a research and a conversation level, so we see the global impact of things like menstrual cycle tracking, and we see athletes coming out and talking about how the menstrual cycle has affected their performance, or they've started training according to menstrual cycle and finding lots of great things about it. So those conversations are there. The research is catching up, but the translation into coaching, into academic teaching is not there. And it's still in that male gaze, it's still in that male lens. It's the same with most biomedical research and biomedical practices. You go to your physician and you say, you know, I'm a 40-year-old woman and I'm pretty stressed out, but I can't sleep. I'm having undue fatigue, I'm putting body fat on, and they're gonna be like, oh, you're just stressed, instead of actually going, hey, wait, no, maybe you're perimenopausal, because they have that male lens. So it's across the board. So I am surprised, but I'm not really surprised, I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
Because this is a younger person who is taking on a class out of interest, being taught by someone who is younger in their career and should be looking into a wider breadth of research and questioning textbooks as we have been taught to do, and is not doing that.
Yeah, for sure. I think actually I'm probably very lucky working at Lattice Training and, you know, being part of a company where people sort of our culture is very much to question what we know, try and learn more and listen to people. I guess being more on the coaching side than the research side, I think you always have this element of, great, I mean, no matter what that textbook says, this person in front of me is telling me something that I really want to try and work with. And that's something I really love about the menstrual cycle and, you know, the great variety in how people experience it and how you can help them to best work with that. So I wonder if, just to get us started and make sure that we're all kind of on the same page, can you just give us a little bit of an overview of the menstrual cycle, some of the key phases, the hormones that are at play, and kind of why, given what we know about those hormones and how they interact in our bodies, why it's important for us to understand it as an athlete?
Yeah, for sure. So I always explain it as if we are looking at a textbook. So, and knowing those variations, but it's set up pretty well where you have a schematic and a typical menstrual cycle is set up as being 28 days, with day one being the first day of bleeding. Around day 12 or 13 is ovulation. And then after ovulation, you have the high hormone phase where estrogen, progesterone come up to around day 28 when they drop off and you start your next cycle. So when we look at that 28 day, with day one, the onset of bleeding, the two female sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are low. So they've dropped off, and that's what's causing the bleed phase. Around day eight, if we're going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, day eight, estrogen starts to come up a little bit. And estrogen rises and has a surge right before ovulation. So we'll say ovulation is day 12. So you have an estrogen surge. Estrogen drops off, and then it starts to come up again after ovulation with progesterone. So progesterone is produced from the capsule, per se, that was housing the egg that was ovulated. So then the progesterone starts to come up. And if there is no fertilization of the endometrial lining, then there's a signal for both of them to drop off and to shed the endometrial lining, which then starts your period again. So when we look at reproductively what's going on here, estrogen and progesterone are really, really key hormones for building your endometrial lining. So progesterone is responsible for breaking down tissue to provide building blocks for the endometrial lining. Progesterone and estrogen both shuttle carbohydrate away from the muscle and the liver to provide a really rich glycogen stores in the endometrial lining. You have a change in your immune system that becomes more pro-inflammatory after ovulation, because now the body doesn't want to have its immune system attack an fertilized egg. So it's like, okay, we have to switch over. So if we know that from a reproductive stance, that when we look at what's happening at all the other systems of the body, we have estrogen, progesterone receptor sites everywhere. And when we're talking about it from a training perspective, when these hormones are low, we have less interference with signaling with regards to being stress resilient. So our immune system is really robust and able to take on virus, bacteria, invading pathogens. We're able to hit high intensities and recover really well because our body is primed to repair and recover tissue because it's not being shut off for endometrial lining. So in the low hormone phase leading up to ovulation, this is where we can look to have high intensity work. We can look to lift heavier. We can look to have a couple of intensity sessions in a row. But after ovulation, we know that with these inherent shifts that the hormones do as it starts to come up, we have to look to drop the intensity, but go more for a muscular endurance type workouts. So this is your steady state cardio type stuff. It's your higher reps, lower weights with muscle and resistance training. And then around the 4 to 5 days before the period starts, when we start to have a transition in these hormones, they're getting ready to drop. We have a big inflammatory response. This is where it's better to allow your body to recover and relax. So we work on skills, we work on drills, we work on recovery metrics. So that's a general schematic, but every woman is different, like you said. So it's really important for us to track our own cycles so that we know how we respond to our own hormone perturbations. So if we have day three of our period and our bleed phase, and we're like, yeah, I start to feel really good on day three, even though I'm still bleeding, I'm going to hit it hard. But maybe on day 23, you don't feel so great. And you know this because you've been tracking, so you're not going to schedule in a key workout on that day. So it gives you an objective view of how you can tailor your training with that undercurrent of what's happening with your hormones to maximize when you should do intensity and when you should back it off.
Yeah, I think that was a really thorough overview there. And actually just like tackling that first kind of introduction of the menstrual cycle. And we will link to, you know, sort of one of those textbook diagrams, because I think that when it's new to people, it's nice to have it in front of them whilst they're listening to something like this. But I remember some really key takeaways for me, which you've covered really nicely there, are number one, kind of bridging that gap between it being a really reproductive focused process to realizing how these hormones are in your blood and there's receptors kind of all over your body. And then also how you've talked about those different phases. I think when you grow up, I don't know about you, I thought the menstrual cycle was my period. And you hear people almost talking about them as if they're the same thing. And obviously that kind of whole cycle that you've laid out there with all these different phases, that is not just the period. And I think that's a really useful step in understanding why it's important for an athlete, because we are training or performing, you know, at many different phases. And there's not just this one that is when you're menstruating, which is, you know, clearly a more obvious phase to know that you're in. So you started to talk a little bit about how we might actually monitor this and think about what training might be most appropriate for us. And I want to come back to that. But before we do, I just want to get your view on sort of the balance of narratives when it comes to thinking about the menstrual cycle in sport. So I speak to some people and they find it really empowering to understand this, understand how they feel on different days, the fact that they are actually, they have some control over maybe when they schedule certain sessions. And then I chat to some other people and they feel, I guess, that talking a lot about the menstrual cycle and sport and performance can play into the narrative of kind of fragility of females in sport. And maybe they think people are saying that females are weaker in a certain phase of their cycle. And I find it really hard to balance because I talk to some female climbers and their experience, they're saying they do feel weaker or that powerful training, it feels less accessible. So I don't know, where do you sit on that? I think it's a really tricky balance.
It is tricky. And the conversation that's coming out of research confuses people even more because you'll have this blanket statement, there's no difference in menstrual cycle phase on performance. And then you have the other, there's menstrual cycle phase variations for menstrual cycle training, like training according to your menstrual cycle. So I'm like, yes, exactly. You're like, what do you mean exactly? It's like, yes, there is no difference on performance for menstrual cycle phase. So on the day of performance, you can nail any PR, you can nail anything that you want to, because you have the training and the taper and you have the environment and you have prepared for that event. The hormone perturbations are very small and minor with regards to what's happening on that day, with regards to your heart rate responses, your vagal tone, the environment that you're used to or not used to, but we work with mental skills. So like I said before, if on day 23, you always feel flat and your key event happens on day 23, in the back of your head, you're going to have, oh, I feel flat on this day. But what we do is we go during training, we're working with our hormones to maximize the training load on particular days where we know that we can absorb that load, recover from it, and adapt, because that's what training is. That's not what performance is. And we're going through and we see on day 23, you feel flat. So yes, we're going to pull back on that intensity, but we can also put in some specific interventions to level the playing field. So we can give you some branched chain amino acids or increase the protein content or give you some more carbohydrate during your session so that if you can't move your session or mentally you want to reassure yourself that you can perform on that day, there are some tools to give you to eliminate that negative flat feeling. So again, when we go to performance, if we're prepared, there's never a negative day to have an event. It's just with training, we can leverage times where our body is really good for absorbing that training load and other times where we should back it down so we don't overreach, overstretch, or get injured. So it's looking at the two difference from, and that's more of that high performance kind of context that I've been entrenched in for so long where everyone's like, oh, how is performance versus what's happening in training?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And actually, that leads us nicely on to some questions I really want to ask you, because when I look at the research and similarly to what you just said, I have people saying to me, oh, there's no evidence that, you know, that performance is any different on any day. So why think about it? You know, it doesn't matter. And like you said, I think it's a really, you know, it's a hard sea of information to swim through, I think, the research, because when you look at some studies out there, it does seem that, you know, not all women feel like their cycle impacts maybe their performance on a given day. And some people do, you know, that's more people's perception of their performance. And then as you've just talked about in the area of more kind of objective measures, you have kind of acute performances and then you have training. And those, I think that distinction is not something that a lot of people come into the research to try and gain more information understand. And as you just said, what is actually quite nice to take away from this is that Okay, cool. Actually, acute performances in a lab environment at quite basic tasks, we don't see really a significant difference. But when it comes to training and what you're doing day in, day out, and the fact that you're actually trying to elicit a response and an adaptation over time, that might be something where we can use some better scheduling or periodization for people with that menstrual cycle. So do you just want to talk about some of those studies? I think they're quite a lot fewer than the acute performance studies. Do you want to talk about some of those studies that look more at that distribution of certain sessions, like in a training scenario rather than an acute performance scenario?
Yeah, so if we look at specifically the sports science research, I think there's about seven key studies that have come out recently looking at phase-based training. So they put a higher load in the follicular phase and a maintenance load in the luteal phase, and they've swapped it to see who gets better strength adaptations, who gets better aerobic adaptations, what's happening with muscle mitochondria. And they're finding that follicular-based training is actually looking to be better for high intensity, for getting that top end, for getting the power. And right before ovulation, there was a study I was reading a couple of weeks ago from Anthony Hackney that if you do the power-based stuff in and around ovulation, which seems counterintuitive when we talk about injury risk and ligament risk, but the body's really primed to take on the power and recover from it. So there are different ways of loading. When we look outside of the sports science research, and we look at things like fertility research, we look at endocrinology research, we look at even something not simple, but like the diabetes and glucose control research. There's so much depth in that research that shows that menstrual cycle affects all of these systems in the body. So when we layer that onto the sports science research that does not have the depth because it hasn't been done until recently, we go, okay, well, what is the one factor that can impede us if we are trying to do high intensity in the high hormone phase? It's inflammation. So what does inflammation do when we're talking about adaptation? If we have too much systemic inflammation or too much inflammation within the muscle itself, yes, we'll have some anti-inflammatory responses that come, but when it's too much, we can't adapt. And we know that we're looking at the endocrinology research, that pro-inflammatory response is responsible for creating signaling to break down tissue because we need that for an endometrial lining. So yes, when there was a reel that was put out by someone talking about, look, there's only seven studies, and this is what it says, and how can you do phase-based training on seven studies? Like, yes, when you're very narrow-minded and you're just looking at those few studies that have just come out, it seems ridiculous to phase-based. But when you layer all the other deep research from other areas on top of it, when you're looking specifically at immune system and adaptations, you're looking at the psychology and motivation and how that changes across the menstrual cycle, how your metabolism changes and glucose homeostasis changes, then it makes absolute sense because there's so much research that shows the menstrual cycle affects these things that also key into performance and training and adaptation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of presenting it, actually, sort of underlying some of the sports performance studies with a kind of a more wealth from that medical side of things, where you do tend to see just, much more breadth and depth in the research when it comes to kind of people's health. And I guess it's interesting, probably for me as a climbing coach. Within climbing, you probably won't know this, but we don't have a wealth of research.
No,
So
we don't. We have a small amount.
we have a small amount. So actually, we do quite a lot of underlying some of the climbing research with research from other sports, or we maybe extrapolate a bit. So I wonder if within climbing as a sport, we're a little bit more comfortable with that process of not having like all those studies, in your area. And maybe that, is something that's quite nice for us in taking on this menstrual cycle information and thinking about it when it comes to programming. And something that I always think is quite interesting when we talk about I guess, periodization and something like phase-based training is that I think there's some common misconceptions, and it'd be interesting to know what you think about this. I think the first one is when you say that you distribute strength training in the follicular phase, I think people see it as a switch. And it's like you only strength train in the follicular phase, then you don't do any for 2 weeks. And
it's crazy.
So, and it's like, no, distribution and planning like this is about like spinning plates. And do you just spin it a bit more and spin it a bit less in the that kind of luteal high hormone phase, just allowing a bit more time to recover between the sessions. I think people see things very black and white when you start talking about information like this, which I think is interesting. The second interesting thing, I think, is that people are very rigid when it comes to other forms of periodization. And yet when you actually look at reviews and some of the studies in periodization as a whole, it's not as solid as people might think it is anyway. So this is some of the things that I try and talk to and explain to people, that actually it's worth experimenting and seeing how it works for you, because a lot of those things that are kind of almost sold to you as being very solid from the sports science sort of textbooks, like you said, in terms of periodization, they actually don't have mountains of solid research behind them either.
No. It's the bro science, because when you think about what it means to be successful in sport, it's all the masculine ideas. So if you go to challenge it within that space that is very masculine, has a lot of male researchers, then people will push back too hard. So that's another reason why a lot of that hasn't been challenged. But when you're talking about menstrual cycle and female health, people are still a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that women can achieve as much as men. And so they push back, and they can push back and have these conversations. But then you have people like us who are like, hey, wait a second. No, there is equality, and we're going to push for it. And we want better methods for training our female athletes because we haven't reached performance potential yet. So we have the voice within instead of the pushback complete.
Yeah, for sure. And you just sort of nailed it there. It's just like, it's a better approach. Like, all of those things out there in the world of sports science, they're all just approaches as well. And I think some people get the idea that when you talk about something like phase-based training or scheduling training around your cycle, like you're doing this wild and crazy different thing. And it's like, no, all sports people will do this. Just the approach is a little bit different. And I also think that plays into the fact that for some, you know, maybe just climbers just listening, they're just very interested in their own performance and they're interested in understanding their cycle. It can also seem quite overwhelming, maybe, if they feel like it's this whole crazy new structure that they have to understand, whilst they're also trying to just generally understand their training needs and their climbing technique and, you know, this whole wide spectrum of things that plays into, you know, any performance, but climbing performance as well. So I guess something that is very useful and kind of underpins being able to think about your training in line with your menstrual cycle is understanding your own menstrual cycle. And obviously this might be something people do with a coach, or it might just be something people do of their own accord. And this sort of process is known as tracking. So can you just kind of explain tracking from a very basic perspective, and then maybe elaborate a little bit on how you see this process fitting into, you know, an athlete's approach to training?
Yeah, so tracking from a basic metric is as simple as putting a star or a note on your calendar on the first day of your period. And then you can do that the next month. So then you can actually see how long your actual cycle is. Excuse me. Because a lot of women don't realize that it's very normal for their cycle to fluctuate a few days either side, right? And it's the follicular phase that changes. So if you have a longer cycle, you have a longer follicular phase. And if you can track that, then you know you have more days to put high intensity work in. So for the basic aspect of going away from just a star on your calendar, just on your calendar, is if you use any kind of training platform, Training Peaks or Training Log, then you put the star on the calendar that says day one, and then you start tracking how you feel on each of your training sessions. So you'll start to see patterns after about three cycles. And this is why I said, like on day 23, if you're always seeing, I feel flat, I didn't have a good session, then you can key in the fact, oh, that's just how my body's responding to the sudden rise of progesterone. So it can be as simple as just making notes across your training plan, or you can be as complex as being a really data-driven individual and use an app where you were like putting in all the information possible about how you slept, what your heart rate variability was, if you ate well or not, you eat around your training, what your training session was, how it felt, how that fits in with the overall plan. And you can be very, very detailed, which can be overwhelming. Apps are good if you're just like, you need to store everything and you can get feedback from it, which is why, you know, I really love Wild because it gives you feedback. There are other apps out there that are more 2D where it just allows you to track and they give you the general idea of what's happening in that day. But the first thing is just really understanding how long your cycle is. And it's just as easy as star to star.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice place to start because I always think, you know, I've spent many years now building up all these layers of my own understanding. And so I go to an app that has a lot on there and gives a lot of feedback and I can understand it. But I always think, I sort of think about it as like peeling back layers on an onion, you know, actually just starting really basic. How long is your cycle is a really good place to start. And in all honesty, when I've chatted to a lot of climbers, this has been really useful and empowering, literally from a preparation standpoint. You're just like, okay, I know how long it is. And then obviously that sort of builds up through to the sort of apps you talked about, which if people are doing a lot of training and they're probably monitoring their sessions anyway, I do feel like these apps fall nicely in line with that. And I mean, I don't know about you, within climbing, the people that I've met, you have different characters in terms of how well they respond to data, whether they get very obsessed with it, you know, and almost zoom in too much on it, which we don't want. It's kind of like softly monitoring the menstrual cycle in the same way I think that you should softly monitor your weights and everything. Because if we zoom in on any one day, we don't get a balanced view of like how things are changing over a whole cycle, over multiple training cycles, you know, a lot of training. Adaptations don't happen in a day. You know, everything to do with your menstrual cycle is not going to change in one day. You know, we can't get too zoomed in. So I always think it's nice to know the breadth of ways that you can track out there so people can find something that kind of feels like it works well for them as well. One thing that I always think is quite interesting is determining when you ovulate. So, you know, when you talked about that phase-based training and, you know, distributing, you know, a bit more of that strength in that follicular phase and then less so in that high hormone luteal phase after ovulation, that, you know, slightly relies on us understanding when we ovulate, which I think can be a tricky thing for people to know when that occurs. If they're not just thinking, cool, I'm a textbook, it'll be, you know, 12 to 14 days. Yeah. I don't know. Can you chat a little bit about how people might be able to understand that phase change for themselves?
Yeah. So if we're looking at subjective data and we're trying to pinpoint ovulation, women will notice that they have a change in motivation around, they'll go from like being motivated and not having fatigue and being able to really withstand some criticism or, you know, high stress loads. And then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, they can't. It's because you've had this switch. With that surge in estrogen, it makes women more cognate and able to take on tasks. Able to be very stress resilient because it is a biological aspect of I'm getting ready to ovulate and I need to be as aggressive as possible from a biological standpoint because I need to find the best mate in order to keep perpetuating the species. So you'll find these mood changes. Temperature wise as well, you might feel like you're a little bit colder or it might be a really hot day and you're not having heat intolerance. Because our core temperature drops by about 0.5 degrees C with that estrogen surge. Our dreams are better as well. We have more slow wave sleep and more dream sleep right before ovulation. Then after ovulation, our temperature starts to come up. We have more disturbance in our sleep, as well as some of those mood changes. If we're looking from a more objective type data, we can use something as simple as basal body temperature, where you go get a BBT thermistor or thermometer from the chemist, and you're tracking, and you'll see a dip in your temperature before it comes back up again, because the delta between the last part of the follicular phase and the about third day of the luteal phase is a degree C, because you drop by at 0.5 and you go up by 0.5 from baseline. So it's a complete degree change, and you'll see this perturbation. And then if you want to put another layer on it, you get an ovulation predictor kit, and you can use that to really dial in the phases. If you're using an IUD and you don't bleed, you can do the same, because you'll still ovulate with an IUD, either copper or progestin, and you can track your basal body temperature and use an ovulation predictor kit to dial in the phases.
Yeah, I think it's useful to try and understand the variety of shifts people might see around there, so they can kind of understand that point where they may want to just make some, you know, certain decisions around their training and scheduling in terms of the load and different intensities of different training modes. And something that I find that kind of confuses all of this a little bit is that it's not the same cycle to cycle. So sometimes I feel like I can really feel that shift, and other times I feel like I don't feel it. And on those cycles where I actually don't notice as much difference, I generally think I'm just not as busy in general. You know, I have plenty of time. I'm getting outside, plenty of sun, my sleep is good. So I don't know if this is a thing, but for me, I guess I feel the experience of my cycle, my phase changes more if I'm generally, like, I guess, more fatigued or have a higher training load in general. So like, say, during the winter, when I actually do push myself in training more, I actually feel like I notice my cycle more. And to me, that makes it more important to understand it at those times. But yeah, I guess my main point is that it's not the same cycle to cycle. So if people are starting out here and trying to understand, they might notice some certain subjective changes, like what you just mentioned. And then the next month, they might be like, oh, that's weird, I now haven't noticed those. Maybe I've just not ovulated. But that's probably not the case.
It's, you know, it's normal not to ovulate. It's normal to have 3 to 4 anovulatory cycles a year. So it could be that, but a lot of it is when you're highly stressed and you're right at that limit, you feel every little perturbation that's happening within your systems.
Yeah. And so the sort of final thing that I would really like to ask you around in this area of the menstrual cycle is supplement use. And I know you actually mentioned a supplement near the beginning when we were talking about acute performances. And as you mentioned, people might have a climbing competition on a certain day within their cycle. They might just be going out to try their project. It's really good kind of weather for it. It's the season to try their outdoor project. And I think alongside that training side and thinking about how we periodize to get the best training adaptations, obviously there is always just trying to get the best out of ourselves in the moment as well. And this is a place where I feel supplements can help, because if there is a certain phase of your cycle where you do feel more fatigued, for example, obviously you can make behavioral changes and try and rest more. I think that is a really great foundation. But I know I've seen a bit about the supplements that can help as well. So I think the world of supplements is pretty murky in general. So could you just give us a bit of an insight into any supplements that have good efficacy, I guess, in this area?
Yeah, so we're talking about an acute dose. Creatine is one of those that is underrated for women, but is very, very useful. So when we're talking about creatine monohydrate, it is naturally produced by the body and is used for all of our fast energetics. So our gut and the gut mucosa that maintains our intestinal lining so we don't get GI distress. All of our fast twitch fibers. So, you know, even though you're isometrically holding, you're still using a lot of ATP to hold on. we're looking at brain and cognition, reaction time, all of that uses creatine. When we are in the high hormone phase, we use a lot of it, but our body is like, hey, I can't quite make enough of it. So if we start to just dose with 3 to 5 grams a day, so it's like a teaspoon, then we get all the benefit of having the creatine, and it helps with all those fast energetics. And it really does help with mood and cognition. They've done some RCTs of looking at SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds, versus creatine doses. And the creatine actually allowed people to come out of mood disorder faster than an SSRI. So if we have acute mood shifts, it's also really beneficial for that, which often happens after ovulation. We have estrogen that comes up and then falls down. It interferes with our neurotransmitters. So if we have acute awareness that we feel a bit flat, creatine is really, really beneficial for that. If we're looking at helping with fueling and reducing some of the aspects of our protein being degraded, and we also want to help with central nervous system, which is really important, especially if you're climbing, then we look at using branched chain amino acids or essential amino acids that have them in there. And it's a powdered form, and put them in your drink bottle so you can use it while you're actually training or you're out. And it significantly helps with cognition, reaction, and delaying a lot of the central nervous system fatigue that comes with elevation of our hormones. When we look at things like beet juice and nitrates, there's no efficacy for using it in women. If you're postmenopause, yes, but not for naturally cycling or younger women. It just doesn't work. Matter of fact, it can backlash for the most part because you get too much vasodilation and then your blood pressure drops out and you don't want that. So when we talk about it, like what's going to help, the big things is creatine and either some protein or branched chain amino acids. Those are the two big factors that totally help with fatigue and the mood and the lack of mojo and the reaction time that were actually really important when we're talking about climbing.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, I think those are some great ones because they're also supplements that, I think a lot of climbers will be familiar with. So it's great to know that those actually can be really helpful alongside the cycle to help us feel like we can perform well throughout. And it's actually really interesting that you pointed to the cognitive effects of those supplements, because one of the things I always wonder when I look at the studies of acute performance, that show no significant difference in different phases of the cycle, a lot of the exercises they use, to my eye, seem quite basic and not like climbing. You know, there's something like a leg press. And it's interesting because when I anecdotally talk to people that I work with or female climbers who are training, they find actually hitting weights and, you know, doing those basic movements as something that fluctuates less in terms of how they perform. Whereas climbing obviously has this cognitive element, a lot of coordination. It's just a very different task than weightlifting. And so it's great that actually maybe with some supplements, they might help kind of bridge that area of the performance as well.
And this is where reaching into the psychology literature, especially in around neurotransmitters and fatigue, central nervous system fatigue, this is what's layering on that sports science research that doesn't give you the full story.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I think we've really covered a lot of interesting points with the menstrual cycle. And I want to segue a little bit. I know you've mentioned perimenopause, menopause, and, you know, climbing is a lifelong sport to so many women out there. And, you know, I very much hope that I will be climbing when I inevitably go through the perimenopause and reach menopause. And, you know, I think menopause is maybe similar to a period in that we fall into the trap of reducing this longer lasting complex transition into this really small unit of time. The menopause, yep. I think, just being this one day when you've not had a period for 12 months, I think. I'm not quite sure if that's right. So I wonder if you could just give a broader description of the transition that is the perimenopause leading up to that point of menopause.
Yeah, so perimenopause can start as early as 35 and can last 10, 15 years. And what it is the fluctuation of our hormones as our body's starting to retire from being reproductive. We really start to see a lot of significant change in women in their mid to late 40s. And that is about the 5 or 6 years before that one point in time, menopause, that birthday on the calendar that's the rest of your life after that. And what we know without any kind of exercise or nutrition intervention, this is where we see the biggest amount of body composition change. So women will lose their lean mass, they'll start losing bone mineral density, and they'll put on a lot of fat mass, especially around the abdominal area. And if women aren't aware of this, then all of a sudden they're like, whoa, what's going on? I got squishy overnight. But it's really this rapid change that's occurring as our hormones are starting to fluctuate, where we're starting to lose progesterone, we're having more anovulatory cycles, we're having more estrogen dominance, or maybe flatlining of estrogen sometimes. And like I said at the start, we have estrogen progesterone receptors everywhere. So when we start having this change in these ratios, every system is affected. So if you think about perimenopause and menopause as pre-puberty, puberty, then people are like, oh yeah, around puberty, all of these changes happen and girls drop out of sport and they're like, what's going on with my body? Same thing, but in reverse. So we're starting to lose our hormones. So we're losing our strength capacity. We're losing our power capacity. We're losing our lean mass. We're losing our bone. And what we know is that the typical training methods that are used so far through women's lives don't work anymore. So this is why we start seeing that women who are really keen on training and adapting, and they're not able to, they start going, shit, I need to train harder and I need to eat less because my body comp is changing so much. But in fact, it's the opposite. We need to change our training and eat to match our training so that we can create an external stress that will allow our body to adapt how the hormones used to support adaptations.
Yeah. So I think you sort of touched on quite a lot there. Obviously, what is happening in the body in terms of like the physiology and the hormones. And it sounds from what you said, like they can change in, it's generally hormone fluctuation. You know, they might be actually going up and down, like really short. They might be just like trailing off and getting low. But essentially, this is what leads to the symptoms people experience that I guess, you know, there's more very common ones, things like hot flushes and stuff like that. But then obviously for the athletic population, you know, climbers do who really care about their you know, their performance and enjoying their climbing, they're noticing maybe this slower recovery, their muscle mass is going down, and you know, then obviously your performance may be affected. So you talked about changing your training in a way that works better alongside this transition. I definitely see this happening, the kind of scenario you mentioned where people just want to add more. You know, they think, oh, you know, I'm getting weaker, I just need to train more. Like you said, they're getting a change in body composition, they want to eat less. I think that is very probably quite common in climbing because it is a body weight dependent sport. So I guess if you started talking to someone or working with someone who is going through this shift and they're noticing the things that you mentioned, like the change in muscle mass and body composition, what are some of the first key things that you think that someone should try?
Changing the resistance training program, because women are so conditioned to doing 3 sets of 10 to 12 or 10 by 10s, like that higher volume type stuff, but that's not what our body needs. When we get to this point where we're having estrogen, progesterone fluctuations, we're having acute dysfunction within the satellite cell of our muscles, as well as a whole nerve to fiber connection. So what I mean by that is estrogen is a driver, like testosterone is for men, but for women in the myosin part of the actin-myosin proteins within the muscle. So you have actin and the myosin grabs onto actin, pulls it, and that's what creates a contraction. When we have estrogen that fluctuates, we lose the ability for myosin to grab onto actin really strongly to create a very strong powerful muscle contraction. So we need to do heavy resistance training, because if we do heavy resistance training, it's telling myosin, hey, wait, we need that. We need to grab on hard. We need to hold on and have a very strong contraction. So it's signaling to the muscle that we need to maintain the integrity of myosin. The other thing that happens when we start to lose estrogen is we have a change in how much acetylcholine is available. So when we're looking at how a nerve activates a muscle, we have this thing called the gap junction, which is this little space between the end of the nerve and where the muscle fiber is innervated. And in order for things to jump over to innervate the muscle for contraction, we need this transmitter called acetylcholine. When we don't have estrogen, we lose a lot of the storage part of the acetylcholine. So there's not as much to transfer over to stimulate the muscle for strong, powerful contraction. If we do heavy resistance training, we're having a big nervous system stress. So the nerve is saying, wait, I need to be able to lift this load. I need more acetylcholine to come in. So it creates more vesicles to hold more acetylcholine to cross over to innervate those fibers. Because the goal from the central nervous system standpoint is to have one nerve that innervates a whole bunch of fibers to contract at once to be able to lift that heavy load. If we're doing that typical 10 by 10, or we're doing, you know, the lower weight, higher volume stuff, we're not stimulating any of that. We're ripping the fiber and we're trying to rebuild it, but we have this miscommunication because the satellite cell, or the actual basal cell that creates more muscle cells, is also being a little bit dysfunctional because we don't have estrogen to stimulate it. So when we're doing the higher rep stuff and we're trying to go for hypertrophy, or we think that's going to get us strong, it in fact can be detrimental, where we're not going to be strong. We're going to, yes, we're going to build lean mass because we're creating a recovery scenario, but it's not strong muscle. It's not strong lean mass. It's not as functional as it could be if we were to stimulate the nervous system and stimulate the myosin in a way that heavy lifting does.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think you're definitely right that there's a culture around a certain kind of rep range that maybe women feel that they should do or could benefit from. And especially, you know, when it's called hypertrophy sets and reps. And actually, you know, if you do look at studies, not necessarily in women in this stage of their life, but you can get hypertrophy in quite a lot of different ways. And you can get through doing obviously more sets of actually a lower rep range that can then be heavier. And I guess you get these benefits that you have just talked about. And one of the things that I think does act as a barrier to performing that sort of training is just competence and confidence with lifting and lifting positions, because I think what I have seen is people get the message about the low rep range, but they can't go ahead. They're not going heavy enough because they are new to weightlifting. You know, they're suddenly like, oh yes, I should start lifting. And so, I mean, I'm definitely an advocate for learning to do those movements. I mean, well, at my age, at younger, so that you actually, you understand how to do them and you feel confident enough to lift heavy and get those responses.
Yep, but it's not too late to start, because I always tell people, look, it's a lifestyle change, it's a lifestyle switch, because if we look at some of the studies where they're implementing more power-based, lower rep, higher weight in women who are 70 and 80, they are able to get more neural connection, and that neural connection helps with prevention and attenuating Alzheimer's, because we have a nerve growth factor, and it feeds forward to help with things like, oh, I stepped off the curb wrong, and instead of falling and breaking a hip, I had the balance and reaction time to come back. So the power training is all about the nervous system. And so when I tell people this, I'm like, look, it's not about right now, where you are in your life right now for performance and getting strong for climbing. It's the eye to what's happening later in life. And if you are climbing later in life, then it's very beneficial. So you want to take this time right now to work and see how you move. So investing in a personal trainer or investing in a physio who understands movement mechanics, then we want to look and see where your restrictions are, how you move. We want you to be able to move well. If you have restrictions, let's work on the mobility aspect. And while we're phasing into the mobility and phasing in to be able to put load on with the technique, we're not giving up resistance training. We can still do the lighter weight, higher rep stuff because we want you to do resistance training. Any is better than none. We don't want you to give it up, but we want you to implement better movement and movement practices. So it's 20 minutes in the gym, not 90 minutes, which a lot of people are like, oh, I've got to spend so much time in the gym. I don't want to do resistance training, but it's movement mechanics. And then we add load.
Yeah, I think that shows a really nice kind of pathway to follow in that working at those higher rep ranges and on the movement gives a really good in for people to understand the movements and to build that familiarity with it, build the confidence, but just understanding that you do want to work towards being able to do some heavier loads to a lower rep range. And I think you're right. It's a sort of, you know, you're doing your body a service if maybe you seek out someone to help you with this and to feel confident doing it. And, you know, I'm sure for anyone listening, there's loads of these compound movements that it's very easy to see the transition into climbing as well. So, you know, you're definitely ticking a box of playing into your climbing performance by doing this too, for sure. So one thing I actually wanted to ask you about was kind of this transition and the cognitive element or people's perception of fear or how this might change. I don't know, this obviously might not be a thing in all sports, but in climbing, something that I have anecdotally heard from people is that, you know, they don't feel as focused. They feel like they get more scared. And I don't know whether you know anything of the underlying mechanism of this or whether you've just come across it as well in other sports.
It's absolutely across the board. When women get into perimenopause and the later part of the menopause transition, there is an inherent change within neurotransmitters, brain, cognitive function, and a lot of it has a fear factor where women become more afraid to do things. And it's plasticity of brain tissue and plasticity of some of the neural connections for that. So it is absolutely real with regards to the extra fear factor and not having the full confidence and cognition reaction that we might have had even a year ago. So this is where working a lot on skills is really important, mental skills, as well as your actual physicality of reaction time and cognition skills. I know it's really kind of crazy to think about, but things like Wordle and Sudoku, those all go really far forward of attenuating that fear factor, of attenuating the brain and plasticity changes that are creating this cascade effect that make women have less reaction or a slower reaction time, poor cognition, and this incredible fear. So it's just working the brain. It's really getting in there and learning new things. And then that really does help with that whole fear of, I don't think I can do that. I can't get that line right now.
That's really interesting. And actually you sort of finished with something interesting there, which was like learning new things. And I guess climbing is quite a learning sport. You learn movements and things like that. But I guess a lot of female climbers who go through this transition, they may have actually been climbing for a lot of years. Like it might be quite a known thing. They actually probably have very good technique and good skills in that area. That's probably not so new to them, which is actually great in that it means that for them, putting a bit of time aside and prioritizing some of that weightlifting is fine because their technical skill is very good. So, you know, if they give a little bit less time for that, that's fine. But that's interesting in terms of that cognition, keeping that focus and maybe being able through that to manage fear better, maybe just through some different brain kind of learning tasks that they could introduce. And, you know, it definitely seems worth trying alongside, you know, within climbing, there's a lot of kind of fear of falling techniques and stuff like that, but that's a slightly different take on it.
Yeah.
So kind of a pretty big thing in climbing, and one of the last areas I kind of want to cover in this kind of perimenopause, menopause discussion with you is the weight element and that body composition change that you've talked about, because with climbing being a weight dependent sport, this will be big for a lot of people. And I don't know, maybe you could explain a little bit why this shift is occurring, but then also the nutrition that can be more appropriate when this happens, if people do see this shift in their body composition, and maybe some of those things that we want to avoid. I always think that's an interesting thing to hear about as well.
Yeah. I wish you could see my slide deck here on the side, because I just wrote a lecture on this today.
Oh, amazing.
I know. So the really interesting thing about the weight gain, there are some signaling changes from estrogen, progesterone that create this cascade to put on more subcutaneous or body fat, as well as a deep abdominal fat. But it really stems from the gut microbiome. So what we're finding in a lot of the newer research is there's this interconnection between estrogen and the gut. And we know that the first pass of estrogen metabolism is through the liver. And then it gets excreted as bile. It's in the gut microbiome, but this is where the bacteria will make the estrogen usable by the body and then push it back into circulation. When we start to have fluctuations of estrogen and progesterone, we lose a lot of diversity in our gut microbiome because we don't have as much coming in for those bacteria to do stuff with. So it's not just estrogen that gets spit back out by the gut, but also progesterone, testosterone, and their other derivatives. So all of our sex hormones becoming active and being their bioactive self in circulation stem from the gut microbiome. So we see a lot of body composition change because we lose the diversity in our gut microbiome. And we start to see the shift in the ratio of the phyla that is promoting more leanness, which is called the bacteriotes. And the phyla of the bacteria that makes us hold on to body fat because it can extract more energy from the food that we eat. And that's the Firmicutes. So in the late perimenopause transition and in postmenopause women, we see that there's a higher Firmicutes to bacteriotes ratio. And this perpetuates that weight gain and the body composition change that we don't want. So what we do know is how to change it. And this is not doing over-the-counter probiotics, but it is eating a lot of fibrous fruits and veggies, lots of different colors, and doing exercise, but not to the extreme. Because if we're doing planned exercise, so short, sharp, high-intensity work, not a lot of volume, then this also encourages diversity in the gut bacteria. So if we're coupling a high fibrous fruit and veg type diet, so we have a lot of deep gut food or deep gut bacteria food with short, sharp, high intensity work, then we can completely attenuate and stop that body composition change. When we look at women who are turning to menopause hormone therapy to try to attenuate body composition change, it doesn't do the same thing because we don't have the first pass of the estrogen like we do with in the liver with our natural estrogen. So we don't have a double take. So it doesn't encourage the growth of that gut bacteria. So it doesn't change the diversity. So when we talk about what do we do for body composition change, it's about diet and exercise to really affect that deep gut bacteria so that we aren't getting the signals to then increase Firmicutes and increase our ability to pull more energy out of the food and increase visceral fat gain.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's interesting. I've heard a lot about the microbiome. You know, we definitely see that now in the world of nutrition, performance, health in general. But I've never understood its link to body composition change during that perimenopause transition. So that's really interesting. And it's nice, I guess, to hear you say, and I'm sure lots of people will feel this way, that you can attenuate and make changes in your diet and exercise that will really help this. Because what I imagine is for people who are going through this transition in life and feeling their body changing, and maybe firstly not knowing why, but secondly just feeling that there might not be anything that they can do about it. And I guess that's some of the narrative and culture that you are trying to change as well and be a part of. And I guess just to kind of round off and finish this conversation, I want to mention the new book that you have brought out, Next Level. And I think a lot of people, I know a lot of climbers have read Raw, and I know a lot of people know you for that book. And when I saw that you had this one out about the menopause, I was like, oh great, this is another piece of work from Stacey, where I feel like you really try to focus on the fact that we can work with our bodies and we can make changes in our nutrition, our exercise to continue to perform and live life in the way that we want and that people are really passionate about. And I guess I just want to hear a little bit from you about the process of what prompted you to write this book.
Yeah, so when Roar came out, we had that one chapter on menopause, and there were so many questions about it. And it was coming on the back end of my work at Stanford, where I was working with Marcia Stefanik, who was the PI of the Women's Health Initiative. So I was in the Women's Health Initiative data. I was doing some small studies comparing human performance, things that we did to improve heat tolerance and improve body composition in athletes, and applying it to women who were peri and postmenopause. So when we wrote the menopause chapter, I was like, oh, this is all the stuff that everyone should know. And I come find out that no one knows anything about it. I was like, but how do you not know this? Like, I've been entrenched in, that's right, I've been in my own little bubble of this whole, like, one foot in human performance and one foot in women's health and understanding what's going on. And it was also at the time where some of my mentors in sport were now reaching perimenopause and wanting to race, and they're being told they're too old, they can't perform. But then we see them still performing and we're like, hey, what's going on? So we'd have these conversations. So the more that kind of conversation was happening in like the pro cycling world and the coaching world, the more I started getting questions about it. And Celine was a little bit hesitant to write and propose this book because she's like, there's nothing we can do, until she started going through it. And she emailed me and she's like, what do I do? And I was like, this. And she comes back to me 2 months later. She's like, oh my God, I put everything in. I just won Iron Cross. I was like, sweet. She goes, now I can write this book. I'm like, great. Because there are so many people who want this information, because there are so many active women who don't fall into the category of typical menopause, where all the research is done on sedentary, obese, sick women who are now a drain on the public burden or a public health system, right? And that's why they're getting the research, and that's why they're getting the information. Where these women are athletes, because if you move on purpose, you're an athlete. They want to take care of their health. They want to keep performing. They want to keep reaching their potential in their sport, or maybe try a new one. And this is the information that's lacking for them. So that's why we wrote the book.
Amazing. And we can link to that in the show notes for the podcast, because although I think that you have gone through some great points for that transition, I have got the book and I've looked at it, and obviously there's just so much in there for lots of different strategies, and there's like some case studies in there. It's really accessible and a nice way for people to try and see how they can take all this information and actually apply it to themselves. I think that's one of the things with the menstrual cycle or the perimenopause, where because everyone is a bit different, there's loads of good information now that people like yourself are putting out there. But to actually see that process of being like, cool, I'm going to pick this, and this, and I'm going to implement it in this way. And I think that's a really nice element of the book as well.
Oh, thanks.
Amazing.
Yes, because I want people to be able to use it and feel better.
Yeah. For sure. And it's interesting to hear how for Celine, it was obviously she got that extra boost of motivation of some personal experience. And I know that she writes that at the start of the book. And it's always nice to kind of, I think, set the scene with something like that when you see how it's worked for someone else.
Yeah, true. I don't think I've read her forward. I don't even have a copy of my book. So I'm going to have to dig it out and go read it.
But like you said, when you're so within that circle, I think it's, you know, you step less outside of it. And, you know, I think it's great. I'm very appreciative of your time. Well, this morning for me, because I think we're still in that place where for you, you see so much of this stuff, you are kind of in there doing the research. But when you step out and you really zoom out, a lot of people still, this will be new to them. And so it's really nice to bring it to them in a podcast.
Oh, thanks. And like I've told other people, it's like, thanks for having me, because I'd be sitting in this room talking to myself and not getting any information.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Stacey.
Yeah, have a great day.
Yeah, you too.